Welcome to Parenting Matters on Nashville Catholic Radio, WBOU 100.5 FM, sponsored by the Family Life Office of the Diocese of Nashville. Your host for the program is Dr. Parr Donahue. Dr. Parr has years of experience in pediatrics and parenting. He was named the Senior Pediatrician of the Year by the Tennessee Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics in 2014. Dr. Parr is the author of four books, including books on parenting entitled Messengers in Denim, The Amazing Things Parents Can Learn from Teens, and Tools for Effective Parenting. Visit Dr. Parr's blog at www.parentingwithdrparr.com. Here's your host, Dr. Parr Donahue.
Welcome to Parenting Matters on WBOU FM 100.5 on your dial and streaming throughout the world on WBOU.org. Our topic today, your family and racism. Our guest is Shelly Jamieson. I'll introduce her in a moment. But a great big welcome to you, Shelly, and to you, our listeners. Now, my monologue. This spring and summer, and perhaps for many months to come, the media have dredged us in constant calls of racism. It seems that most anything people say is called racist, regardless of the meaning or intent of the speaker. Sure, there have been some horrid racist attacks, but the intensity of the coverage has turned many non-racists against their own cause. No one can justify the killing of George Flynn, and to my knowledge, no one has. I don't believe we have systemic racism. Our republic is not racist, but we do have individual racism. So if you are for or against the actions of the demonstrators, if you think the demonstrators have done too little or too much, and you are as tired of it as I am, the question remains, what can a parent do about the situation? And how can they assure their kids will not become racist? I want to remind my listeners of my first mantra of parenting. Your children will become you. If you haven't noticed that you are becoming your mother, or that your husband is slowly acting more and more like his dad, just wait. It will happen. There are even ads on television exploiting this social phenomenon. Having said that, it is possible that if you or your spouse desire not to pick up some of your parents' habits, you can avoid them because they're not on your DNA, but it will take constant attention and hard work. Now back to the point of today's show. If you are a racist, your kids will be racist. If they do not see racism in you, they will not be racist. So take a look at yourself. Do you have some work to do? Here's a few things to consider. When we approach a checkout counter with multiple checkers of different races, do we automatically go to the checker who is our same color? Do we associate with our neighbors who are of a different race as much as we do with those whose skin matches ours? Do we feel uncomfortable in a meeting if the majority of those meeting are racially different than we are? Do we get irritated with TV commercials who have actors that are not of our race? Can we have a conversation with others of different political parties without getting worked up, angry, or disagree on policy and remain friends? Do we think our employer is wasting money on diversity issues? He may be, but are we willing to discuss that with him and see what the committee is doing and offer alternatives that cost less money and offer better solutions to the inequities in the workplace? It seems that racism isn't really about race. It's about getting along with those who are different than we are. But before we call ourselves racist, let's ask ourselves, are we really just too sensitive? Eleanor Roosevelt reportedly said, "No one can make me angry without my permission." And I agree. I've tried for many years not to let anyone get me angry or even upset. But to paraphrase Mrs. Roosevelt, let me say, no one can offend me without my permission. That does not mean avoiding discussions of difficult topics, avoiding difficult people, or avoiding my uncle, who is politically ignorant and lets everyone know it by telling us all whom he voted for. He knows that we all would disagree with the ballots he casts. He tries to anger us because he knows that anger interferes with how people think. They don't think right. And then after they speak, before they think. And when they all do this, their feathers fly and day is destroyed for everyone. I admit I sometimes lose it and come home with a bleeding tongue, but that happens a lot less since I learned what Eleanor Roosevelt really meant. I no longer bristle when someone misinterprets what I said. One of my sisters taught me long ago that we should practice, quote, Irish diplomacy. Now, pardon me if that offends my Irish friends. Irish diplomacy is the ability to tell someone to go to hell in such a way that they look forward to the stay. Now, if you watch TV, you know exactly what I mean. Just think of the speech President Trump gave at Mount Rushmore. Fox News called it a great speech, one which will go down in history, one which will change the course of history, while CNN said it was one of the most divisive speeches in history, and he should not even have gone to Rushmore because it memorializes racists and traitors. However, they applauded President Bush and Obama when they went there, and candidate Bernie Sanders. They spoke at the same venue, so that proves that sensitivities can change. So here we are. Let me tell you the first thing you should tell your kids about difficult conversations. Some people are more sensitive than others. Tell your kids that they should not be offended by what others say. After all, distorted words, or even words that are true, but spoken in an attempt to offend, irritate, or anger, do not reflect on you. Do not reflect on your children. They only reflect on the person who sends them. Unless, of course, you react offensively. The words reflect on the one who speaks them. You must also comfort your child and tell them you know those words can hurt, but help them understand they do not apply to you as a child. And as they get older, those words will not hurt. Then remind them to not act like the person who demeaned them. I didn't know much about racism. Let me be the first to admit that. I grew up in a small farm on a tiny little town, 250 people in Minnesota. I didn't see a black person until I was about 12 or 13. Our dad took a truckload of pigs to market in South St. Paul, and my brother and I got to go along. There we saw three young black boys walking down the street. We gawked at them. They looked just like Lenny, my brother, and me. I'd never seen a black person before. We didn't have television back then, and rarely saw a movie. And as far as I know, there were no blacks in movies back then. The next encounter with a black man was my junior year in college when our school admitted its first black kid. He lived on a different floor in the dorm, and although I saw him around campus, he was not in any of my classes. The first black man I really knew was a classmate of mine in medical school. He and I became friends, and one day he and I and three other kids were talking between classes about our heritage. One of the boys, John Schultz, said he was a third-generation German. I boasted that both my grandfathers were born in Ireland, so I was Irish. Then Ron DeMint said he was French, and then turned toward our black friend, Don Passé, and said, "Passé, you must be French too." Don laughed and said, "No, Ron, in case you haven't noticed, I'm African." We all had a good laugh. Today, Ron would be called a racist for not acknowledging Don's blackness. 50 years ago, we thought it was a sign of endearing friendship. And it was. Ron and the rest of us judged Don not by his skin color, but by the strength of his character. Since that time, I have met many blacks, most of them professionals, military men and women, or patients that I had. So I admit my view of black people is a bit different from most, but our guest has a much different experience. That's one of the reasons I asked her to be on our show. Mary Shelley Palmer Jameson was born in Alabama and raised in a small town in Mississippi where her father was the Baptist preacher. She has a bachelor's degree from Belmont University and a master's in guidance and counseling in elementary school from Middle Tennessee State University. She has taught every grade from kindergarten through ninth. She worked for the state of Tennessee in child protective services, foster care, adoptions, and adult protective services, and later as a guidance counselor in K through 8 schools. She is author of two books, How Did I Get Here, The Root of the Matter, and How Did I Get Here from the Ground Up. Her husband Jim is a CPA and has worked in industrial accounting, public accounting, and education. He taught at UT before spending 20 years as a professor of accounting at Belmont. God has blessed them with two sons, a daughter, 6 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandchildren. They worship at Brentwood Baptist Church. Welcome, Shelley, to Parenting Matters on WBOU 100.5 FM and streaming throughout the world at WBOU.org. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Dr. Donahue. It's my pleasure to be here, and thank you for asking.
You're so welcome. Shelley, I got to know you as Shelley, but I included Mary in your name to let you know that I really read your last book. Tell our listeners the story of your name.
Well, my parents had been married for 15 years when I was born. They raised a foster child, and she was 15 years old when I was born. My mother had been a teacher for 15 years, but she'd gone back to get a degree because she was able to teach without a degree at that time. And she decided that maybe she was pregnant. So she went to a doctor friend, and he examined her, and he said, Mary said, you have a tumor, and this summer after school's out, we will go to Memphis and remove it, and you'll be fine. Well, before it was popular, my mother went for a second opinion, and she got the diagnosis that she wanted to hear. She was pregnant. That same doctor friend drove to Alabama to deliver me, and then I didn't have a name because my parents could not agree on a name. And I'm kind of glad they didn't, because I didn't particularly like the names that they were considering. My doctor friend came to visit when I was 6 weeks old, and he found out I did not have a name. You could do that back then. You didn't have to have a name before you left the hospital. He picked me up, and he said, her name is Mary Shelley Palmer. Mary was my mother's given name. Shelley was her family name. So I've worn the name Shelley very proudly, because I really think I came from a great family.
I guess you did. And I'm sure they think you have lived up to it. You have a very different relationship with black people than I did. Tell us about it.
Well, my father was a minister, and at one point he was in the most backward county in Mississippi, and he had the position of associational missionary, where he helped all the churches in the county. He spoke in the counties. He preached in the counties. He did study courses. He did vacation Bible school. And I've got pictures of maybe 75 kids and one little white face in the group, and that was me. My daddy spoke in schools, in black schools. Most of them were one-room schoolhouses. And I tagged along. I wasn't just a tag along. So I was there. There were none living near us, but my friends who lived on farms usually had people on their farms that were helpers, and they were black, and they were playmates. I played with them. There was a saying I heard once that kind of stuck with me. It said, in the North, people saw the blacks. They liked the race, but they didn't like the individuals. In the South, we didn't particularly like the race, but we loved the individuals because we got to know them. We played with them. We worked with them. They were in our homes. So I think that was a difference, that I had contact and I saw them in a different way. My grandmother always had a maid. One stayed with the family for 30 years. And she was family. Oh, affectionately known as Mama Hawkins. And then later, and she kept me when I was a baby some. And then later, the next lady that worked for my grandmother, she and I stayed friends until she died. I visited her when I was in Alabama. She sent me, she would pick pecans in the fall and pick them out and mail me a cake for Christmas. I had the privilege of doing a few things for her during those years. So we loved them.
And Suni, I liked your saying about you love the individual. And I think that in the North, in my time, I had no chance to love because I didn't have any chance to know. And I think you have to know,
right,
and before you can love. But I had just no feelings about race because I didn't even hardly know they existed. You witnessed segregated schools and black and white fountains and other signs of racism, did you not?
Yes.
How did that affect you? What did you think?
Well, you know, it was just the culture.
Yeah.
And as a very young person, I didn't think much about it. I think the thing that bothered me the most was they couldn't eat in the restaurants with us. In the movie theater, they were sitting in the balcony and they had a separate door. And I knew in my heart all the time, that's not right. That's just not right. And I know many were mistreated, yet we had respect for them.
You were also a teenager, young adult, when they brought integration in. How did that work for you?
Well, actually, I was an adult. I was not in school. Really, when that first came about, I was a young mother. I had three kids in 4 years, and my life was pretty much centered around my kids, and I was not involved in anything. My first year to teach was in at a junior high school, and that would have been in 1967. And there were already black kids in the school. That was no problem for me. And, you know, I'm trying to think back. That was a long time ago. But they had the same fountains. They used the same restrooms. They ate together. So that was just, I never saw a problem with the kids, excepting the black kids and the black kids mingling with the whites. It may have happened, but I didn't see that, so I didn't experience that.
Good, good. Shel, I mentioned a few subtle actions that might make one think he's a racist or she is. Can you give us some more examples?
Well, like I said, being in the theaters, and that was mostly it, mostly. Of course, we went to churches separately. But I always saw that not as a color thing. I saw that as a cultural thing, mm-hmm. that they worshiped differently than we did. Of course, I worshiped in black churches, but not many did mm-hmm. at that time. But I just saw it more as a cultural difference. Their style of worship was much different from ours, mm-hmm. and ours were different. And I always thought they would not be real comfortable mm-hmm. in our church, mm-hmm. and most of our people would not be.
But it wasn't necessarily racist. Was it more religious? I mean,
I think it was culture. It was culture. Just culture, yeah. More yeah. culture yeah. than anything. Yeah. That's the way I saw it growing up.
Are you seeing anything these days around your life that you would consider racist today?
You know, I'm not seeing it. I'm like you, most of the black people I have contact with have been professionals. Mm-hmm. I taught with them. Mm-hmm. I did my student teaching in 1972-3. And a black teacher was my supervisor, mm-hmm. one that I worked mm-hmm. under. In schools and all the jobs that I've had, most have been professionals. And, you know, I don't see the color. I see the person.
I appreciate that. Shelley, you have a daughter-in-law who is black. So you must have done something to instill this equality, I guess, in your family. Tell us about your family's race.
Well, I thought about that, too. And I thought back, I don't know that I did anything intentional. But I looked back and I thought, well, I must have done something right mm-hmm. along the way. Mm-hmm. I think my husband and I both feel that God made everybody, and he loves us all the same. And there were culturally differences I'll have to admit that when they got engaged, we were upset about it because we saw the differences, and our concern was not the color. Our concern was that how are they going to be accepted? What kind of problems are they going to face? This was like in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So things were a little different than they are now. Yeah. And when they have children, is this going to be problems for the children? And that was our concerns. And once when we realized that they were getting engaged and they were going to get married, my husband said, David, you love Karen, we'll love Karen. If you have children, we will love them just like the rest of our grandkids. And that's what we've done. And we've handled it with a sense of humor. That's our family has done that a lot when there's any kind of problems. And we can joke. We can joke about it. I think I told you about the time we had professional pictures taken of the family outside and they couldn't get the light right, and finally they got it. We have to move, move, move. Finally they got it right, and they said, we got it, everybody but Karen. And we all turned and we said, Karen, you have messed up the family picture. Of course, we all laughed. And then one time, my daughter-in-law met a lady and found out, just by talking to her, that she was in the same Bible class that I was in. And so she said, oh, my mother-in-law's in that class. You need to meet her. And she said, she was telling her husband about him, our son, and she said, I described him, said she could not figure out which one she was. As I said, she's short, she has gray hair, and she couldn't, she said she didn't know who she was. And my son said, Karen, did you tell her she's white? She said, well, no. She didn't even think about the fact that we were a different color. So she has been a part of our family, and there's no been no problems.
Good, good. You know, I was listening to a guy named Bob Woodson on TV the other night. He's an older black man, and he has a very interesting perspective. He was a civil rights leader in the 60s and continues to be an outspoken defender of civil rights. But he says the problem with the black race is because of the poverty and lack of families. And these two things need to be resolved by having two-parent families. He tells us that in the 1920s, during the, what we call the gay 20s, or what they call it, blacks, about 85% of couples were married, and whites, about 85% were married. Then came the Depression, and the whites split, a lot of them. Blacks got more connected. So that after the Depression, during the Depression, there were more married blacks than married whites, percentage-wise. And then he said everything was going on pretty well until the anti-poverty campaign, when they started paying people who had no spouse more money than those who did. And so the more kids you could have and the fewer husbands, the more money you got. They said this is really what ruined the black race. It's a very interesting thought. He has opening remarks in his book, The Triumphs of Joseph, which I would recommend that book, except that I went online. It was published about 10 years ago, and it was only one online. It was like $49, but there was some for sale for $300. So I wasn't going to buy one and see if they have it at the library. The Triumphs of Joseph. He says, and I quote, to continue to focus on racism as the principal enemy of the black community is to go down the legal path of self-deception. Our communities are dying of self-inflicted wounds. Then he adds that in 2018, there were almost 8,000 black-on-black murders in the United States, a figure that has been growing ever since. And that does not include the more than 250,000 black babies killed by abortion. Shelley, you are an experienced social worker, and you have seen firsthand before and after segregation. Is our nation really integrated, or are we sort of living in a pseudo-integration while being really intellectually segregated?
Well, you know, I really don't think it as a problem with segregation or integration. I see it as codependency. You know, several years ago, books were written, and the topic so much was being codependent.
Yeah.
The people that we knew and loved, trying to help them to get out of addictions or other behavior problems. And actually, many times we were doing things that supported and encouraged that. Well, I think as a nation, we've been codependent. Does that make sense?
It surely does. Sure does.
When you're already in poverty, and you are given everything you need, we are supporting that poverty, and it has grown. Mm-hmm. So I totally agree with him on that.
Well, I could talk about him all day. I really could, because you said so many great things. But there are other voices we need to hear, too. A lady called Heather McDonald has her book called The War on Cops. She says, a straight line can be drawn between family breakdown and youth violence. While that gap exists, the crime gap won't close. So I'm not saying black lives don't matter. I'm not saying it's a bad organization. They have reason to protest and to demonstrate. But what I object to is that some in the movement have turned to violence. No one, including me, can justify looting, arson, or damage to people's property. I read in this morning's paper there was damage of $15 billion to Minneapolis from those riots. That has to stop. And the other thing that bothers me is that the Black Lives Matter movement was founded by three Marxists. And that is not good for the American people, and especially for the young people who are so easily swayed by peers or adults. So if Mr. Woods and Don McDonald and Black Lives Matter are all wrong or all right, what's a parent to do?
My summation of all that is that it's a lack of respect. Mm-hmm. When we were growing up, we respected our leaders, our teachers, our president, our parents. We're not seeing that today. We're not having respect for life. If we respected life, we would not be destroying things or people. So I think it's respect. And where does respect come from? We go back to what you said to begin with. We become our parents. We have got to instill values into our children, young, and it has to be intentional. It doesn't just happen. You have to know the values. First of all, you've got to know where your values are, that you agree on your values, and that God is a partner in those values and not the world. The world has too many values to choose from. God has one.
I just love it. I love it. Thank you so much. You know, Pope John Paul said way back in, I think, 64, that that was Paul back then. But when John Paul was, he said, we have developed a culture of death, and we don't mind killing babies. We have no respect for life anywhere else. So thank you so very much. I think it's about time to close this up. It has been a great pleasure having you on the show, Shelley, and talking with you, our listeners. You're listening to WBOU FM 100.5 on your dial and streaming throughout the world on WBOU.org. Before I sign off, one quick story. 8 years ago, I saw an 18-year-old black man who had his heart set on being a Marine. He and his fellow applicants were watching the news when I called him into the exam room. After our interview and examination, I told him he had passed and qualified for the Marines. We talked a lot about his future, and I noted the fact that he was watching the news, so I asked him if he was interested in politics. He said, no, not really. I said, well, have you registered to vote? He said, no. I said, well, you know, you have a chance to decide who your boss is going to be. I would think that would be important to you. And he thought, well, I guess. He said, I never thought about that. I thought voting wasn't for young people, just for older ones. Well, we continued our conversation, and finally I asked him, if I can ask you a really personal question, have you ever had what kind of racist problems have you faced? And he looked at me and he scowled and he says, none. I said, none? He said, well, I have been called the N-word a couple of times, but it doesn't bother me. It just reflects on the guy who told me. And now I know what kind of guy he is and I avoid him. It's not a big deal, he said. He shrugged his shoulders and said, some kids I know get really upset with that word, but I just look at the source. I don't need people like that. Well, I told him, I don't either. Now for your homework, get your family together and listen again to the show on parenting-matters.com. Discuss the show with them. Examine how you and your family see racism. Set a goal to correct any misunderstandings any of you have and plan to befriend people who are different from you. Then go back to www.parenting-matters.com. Click on homework and tell us what you discovered. And if you have a topic you would like to hear discussed on Parenting Matters, let us know. We'll find an expert to tell us all about it. Thanks for listening, and may God continue to bless you and your families.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Parenting Matters with Dr. Parr Donahue. Parenting Matters is produced and recorded inside the studios at the Catholic Pastoral Center. Thanks again for listening to WBOU 100.5 FM and streaming at WBOU.org.